with the group, sort of.
The House Committee on Revenue for May 22, 2009 will come to order. We have a number of items on our agenda today, and I want to simply announce some changes so that people won't be waiting around looking for a bill to come up that isn't coming up today. I want to note that our staff, Legislative Revenue Office, Legislative Fiscal Office, Legislative Council, and the other committee staff are working very, very hard to close other committees and get us out help us get the session finished. So you're going to hear me say that things aren't ready, and part of it's because we've asked them to do a great deal, and part of it is because a lot of other committees have asked them to do a great deal as well, these various groups. I want to let you know that yesterday we took House Bill 2002 off the agenda. That issue has been resolved. We will be holding over House Bill 2069 till Tuesday, our next meeting time. We are going to hold a short hearing toward the end of this session on House Bill 2914, our actually work session. I've invited one person to testify about some of the issues on the Reconnect Bill, but we don't expect to work it today. We're holding over until further notice House Bill 2873. There are some additional amendments needed on that bill. House Bill 2904 has a new fiscal that needs some attention and some work and an amendment. So we're holding that over as well. I'm not ready to reschedule that as yet. We will probably take no further action on House Bill 2913. And with that, we will open a work session on House Bill. A public hearing on House Bill 3405. I'm going to hand the gavel to Representative Bailey and go down and testify on the bill. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Phil Barnhart. I am the State Representative from House District 11, and I want to talk about the bill that's before us today and to note first that we should ignore completely what's actually in the bill because it's not related to the topic of our conversation. The relating clause, however, as you'll note, is an excellent one for our purposes. Today, what we want to present, and have with me the Chair of the Finance and Revenue Committee of the Senate, we want to present today a proposal having to do with a revenue package involving the corporate taxes and fees, and talk a bit about, and my assignment here is to talk a bit about the theory of what we are trying to accomplish, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague to talk about some of the details. We had an amendment for today. Unfortunately, it has several serious flaws in it. While it's in your packet, I think you should ignore it because there are several things that have to be changed in it. What we're going to say is what we intended the amendment to do. First, let me say that in dealing with corporate taxation, I think it has been a general perception for some time in the public and in other places that we have allowed for profitable businesses and businesses with very large footprints in Oregon that may not be profitable in a particular year to avoid paying any significant tax to the state by simply paying a $10 minimum tax. So a piece of our proposal has to do with the $10 minimum tax. Our approach to this has been to try to protect small business. We think it's important because small business is the generator of most of the jobs in Oregon and most of the innovation that leads to that's going to lead us into the new economy will come from small business. And so part of what you'll hear will include our object that small businesses be protected as much as possible. And then that businesses be taxed to the extent possible based on their size. And we'll talk a little bit about what we mean by that. in connection with the minimum tax. We've also suggested a marginal tax rate increase, again, protecting small businesses. The object, again, being those profitable small businesses would be held to the same rate that they pay now. And in keeping with that, we're also proposing some changes in the fee structure. But again, these are small fee increases designed to deal with our revenue issue, and we think are related to the nature of the kinds of businesses, the corporations that we're talking about, and also to the nature of the kinds of issues that they raise. And I think that I'm going to stop there and let Senator Burdick give you the details, and then perhaps we can answer some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Other Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18. And I want to start my remarks here to tell you about the details of the package, but I want to begin by saying that this has been a difficult process in many ways, but the expertise and good humor of your chair has really made the negotiations a lot easier. He has a lot of experience in this area, more than I do, and I just want his committee to know what a pleasure and it has been to work with him. So I'll have my money now. So my assignment is to do the details of this plan. It has three basic parts in the amendment that you'll have before you. The first part is a new corporate minimum. And basically, this minimum starts out with a flat $100 minimum for all C-Corps and S-Corps in Oregon. And that is a considerable increase from the current minimum of $10 that has not been reset since the 1930s. In addition, for C-Corps only, not S-Corps, but C-Corps, with gross receipts above $500,000, a marginal tax rate of those gross receipts of 0.15% is applied up to a cap of $60,000, and it starts with the 2009 corporate tax year. The estimated revenue that will be generated from this is $135 million for the 2009-11 biennium. The second piece is a new corporate income tax rate structure for profitable corporations. This would, again, in keeping with the principle of protecting the smallest businesses, it would retain the 6.6% rate on the first $250,000 of net income for profitable corporations, and it would apply a new marginal rate of 8.2% to corporate net income above $250,000. And this also starts with the 2009 corporate tax year, and the estimated revenue gain from this part of the proposal would be $122 million for the 2009-11 biennium. The third piece is a new filing fee structure for corporations and companies that file with the Secretary of State. All entities currently pay a $50 filing fee, and we've added an additional $25 to this fee for nonprofit corporations and companies, $50 for domestic corporations, and that means corporations that are based in Oregon, and then an additional $100 for corporations that are based outside of Oregon. This part of the proposal would not start until January 1st of 2010. And the estimated revenue for 2009-11 biennium would be $20 million. In addition, part of our corporate tax recommendation is modifications to the business energy tax credit, which you have already sent through this committee. It's currently pending in my committee, and we're hoping to increase the revenue gain from this bill to $23 million for the 2009-11 biennium. And if you add all these pieces up together, the total estimated revenue gain for the 2009-11 biennium is $300 million. And that's the corporate share, the complete corporate share of the $800 million package that we have forwarded to the Ways and Means Committee for their budgeting. I'd be happy to answer any questions with my co-chair here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Representative Bruin.
Yeah, a couple of questions. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the two most striking pieces of this for me are the 0.15, which you're calling a gross receipts tax. We're talking revenue, correct? Top-line revenue. For corporations, make sure I have this, over, that have top-line revenue over $500,000. Did I write that down correctly?
Correct.
Okay. And for me, once again, the second piece of this that stands out is the change in corporate tax rate, current 6.6. If their earnings prior to tax are less than $250,000, moving to 8.2% over $250,000. Can you tell me how sort of some of the history of the process? I know you were in negotiations work group, who you were negotiating with, how you came to these numbers versus any other number, and then it was part of that analysis, was there a comparison to other states, especially close in the states, but just generally where that puts Oregon corporations, both big and small, on a tax competitiveness footprint versus the other 49?
We can get the rates for the ratings for the last piece of your question. I don't have it today.
Well, my question would be more, did it come up in conversation in the negotiations?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Oregon, of course, as you know, based on the surveys that have been done in the last couple of years, is somewhere between 8th and 10th best in the country based on business taxes. That is the lowest business taxes. I think this puts us somewhere closer to the middle of the pack, but I'd have to go out and analyze that again in order to see. The other problem, of course, is that that's a moving target because other states are also considering tax increases, so it's hard to know for sure. To get back to your first question, how did we get here? We started out with a proposal that we ought to base the size of business calculation, not on gross receipts, but on some form of a business activity basis, which would include things like payroll, a cost of funds, rents and royalties, or other things of that sort, which would exclude cost of goods sold and that kind of thing. As we discussed this issue with the business community, it was clear that let me put it this way. I didn't hear any business say they liked that approach. many said they liked the gross receipts approach better. And in my view, from a theoretician's point of view, because the only business I've ever run has been a very small psychology practice, from a theoretician's point of view, I think that the BAT would have been a better gauge of corporate size than the gross receipts was, but I think it's fair to say that we bowed to the opinion of the business community on that subject, and that's why our proposal contains a gross receipts base instead of a business activity base.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Just a quick follow up. I guess one of my questions would be, though, how did you establish the rate setting? Was it a number that you tried to back into, or was there $300 million is the target? Here's the rates, some gyrations to get there, or do we look at what's an acceptable range, a non-harmful tax range, and here's what we get from it?
I think all of that was within our calculation. I personally started out, and I would not attribute this to the chair of the Senate committee at all. I personally started out with the idea that, if possible, we should fill the budget hole. And I'm hearing thoughts behind me about that. I quickly concluded that those thoughts were correct. And then the question became, what portion of the budget hole could we expect reasonably to fill during the biennium? The other consideration that I had, and I frankly, it's hard to speak for other people because there were a lot of people involved in the conversation, and I'm sure they all had their own motivation for the positions that they took. But for me, the main theme of this proposal isn't that it fills a budget hole this session, but that it increases the likelihood of tax fairness. Oregon has a tax system which is more progressive than many other states, but less progressive than others and less progressive than it could be. And establishing a system which does a reasonable job of sizing the taxes so that they don't negatively affect business, but that they so that they are progressive, is, I believe, a benefit. Now, it's very hard to speak for other people. And so that's one of the reasons why this proposal made sense as a piece of the entire package. When we get to the other part of the package sometime next week, you'll see, I think you'll see better how they fit together.
Mr. Chair, one last, and then I'll stop. I appreciated the testimony from both of you at the beginning of your comments, saying that when you went and as you were carrying out your conversations and sort of the devising this plan to take special care to protect Oregon's small business, and mentioned that it's certainly the creator of most jobs and will of course be the gateway to tomorrow's economy, if you will. So I agree with that absolutely. I'm struck by, however, the scenarios I see, and I'd just like to hear your thoughts and comments on these. A company that earns net income prior to tax less than $250,000 or more than $250,000 may or may not be a small business, depending on how you define small business. Mm-hmm. However, a company that has top-line revenue at $500,000, I think by anybody's standard, is a small business. So I'm particularly concerned about that and how you arrived at such a low number for that gross receipts tax.
I think we're busy trying to protect the smallest businesses, and the point you're making, I think, is a good one. I think the point to remember too is that these two things interact. A corporation would pay whichever of these two taxes was higher. We, in our scenarios, and you've seen them, we didn't see any examples of likely situations in which a profitable business would actually pay the corporate minimum tax. But at least arithmetically, there are some where a $40 million business, which is, by the way, is the line where you hit $60,000 on the minimum tax if you have no profits, about $40 million. Of gross sales. So a $40 million business might be barely profitable and have a tax based on their profitability of less than $60,000 and therefore pay the cap onto the minimum tax instead. So those two things do interact. I think the way we arrived at the number was what we thought we could afford out of the tax receipts and what we thought would protect a very large number of small businesses. A very large percentage of the total businesses in Oregon do gross less than $500,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other questions? All right. Representative Ritter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd kind of like to change direction here and ask the good chair of the Senate Revenue Committee. The last bullet point here discusses the business energy tax credit, which this committee spent a lot of time.
Yes.
What is your what are you contemplating? Is it the same bill? Are you contemplating changes to the bill that came out of here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we will use the same bill that you had through here. I think we have some of the richest tax credits in the country, and they have paid off. At the same time, we have had a revenue impact that is more than doubled from what it was projected to be for the next biennium through these energy tax credits. So in an economic time like this, I think you see it in this package, you'll see it in the other package. We really are trying to draw a balance between the goals we're trying to accomplish and what we can afford in the current economic situation in our revenue stream. The changes that I would have in mind, and we haven't actually sat down and worked it over, but the changes that I would have in mind would continue to keep a core program to attract the kind of renewable energy manufacturing, that type of thing that would produce jobs, to maintain a good program to get the returns that we're seeing from the business energy tax credit, but try to hone it down in recognition of the economic situation we're in now.
It seems then that for us, the Betsy is indeed the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of the moment. Is
Chair of the moment.
I'm curious about the thinking that went into the allocation of responsibility to corporations on the one hand, and what will be the personal income tax on the other. And secondly, I'm interested in knowing if this is viewed as a forever arrangement or a temporary arrangement as we work our way through these difficult times. So two questions.
May I?
Yes.
Let me start with the second one first. Since we consider this to be part of the tax fairness issue, these taxes, to the extent they're that they by nature can be permanent, they would be. Obviously, the Betsy piece is temporary by its very nature. The other pieces would be expected to be permanent. And, of course, you recognize, and I do too, that the legislature can at any time reduce these changes with a simple majority vote or increase the taxes in them by a three-fifths vote.
And the first question was the allocation of roughly a third to the corporations and two-thirds, mm-hmm. as I understand it, to the personal side. I'm just curious what the thinking was that went into that allocation.
3/8 and 5/8. Do you want to talk about that one?
Well, right now, it works out to about 37.5% corporate share, and the other percentage personal share. But you have to keep in mind that a big chunk of that share is the corporate minimum, which has been, I think it's widely recognized by just a lot of people, that the $10 corporate minimum was really not a realistic minimum tax to have in Oregon. So a big part of that impact is the restructuring of the corporate minimum. If you take just the marginal rate piece of it, the percentage goes down substantially.
In that, it would be of interest to see on our corporate profile for the state of Oregon where most of this cost is going to fall, setting the corporate minimum aside for a moment. Because I don't want to assume anything. There must be charts or graphs or something we're going to be shown that will show us who is actually going to end up paying most of this tax.
And Mr. Chair, I think, Representative Bentz, I think we have staff that will be helping us with that, and there are also people sitting behind us who will shed some light on that, I'm sure.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions following on Representative Bruin's line of questioning. I'm curious about just to understand the hydraulics within the corporate minimum structure. Is it correct to say that there are no thresholds within this structure, that the way that it's structured is that the between $499,999 of gross receipts and $500,001, that it is that $100 plus the the 0.15% of that additional dollar that's on top?
Yes, all corporations will get the benefit of the $500,000 exemption. So it's everyone will get that exemption, if that's what you're asking.
I think in the case that you proposed, if I'd done the arithmetic right, it would be the tax would be $100.15.
And is there a reason that a smooth slope based on the gross receipts tax for an increase in corporate minimum is preferable to a bracket system based on gross receipts? Mr. Chair, that would be a stair step where from a certain amount of gross receipts to a certain amount of gross receipts, the corporate tax would be $150, and then from the next bracket it would be $300 or something to that effect.
Well, I think the reason we didn't do, there's two reasons why we didn't do that, I think. One is that for that the dollar numbers on very large corporations that did not make a profit startled some people when you started looking at them, which is the reason why there's a cap in this thing in the first place. I was personally opposed to putting a cap in the minimum tax, but theoretically, at least, there are a few corporations in Oregon which, if there was no cap, could end up spending several million dollars in a bad year, a year in which they didn't make any profits, several million dollars just on the corporate minimum tax. So this cap actually protects those very large businesses. The other reason for not having a stair step or bracket approach is that if you're really trying to base the minimum tax on the size of the business, a tax which is completely flat makes more sense. As I indicated, I'd have preferred no cap because that would more accurately reflect the real size of the non-profitable business. Perhaps more prudent voices overruled me.
I might ask you one more. We've had some discussion in this committee, but it has been many weeks, and I'm forgetful. Could you describe for me the theory of the corporate minimum? Why is there a minimum tax on businesses?
Shall I go for that?
Okay, sure.
Good. There are competing theories, and we've heard them in this committee. We've heard a number of proponents of a flat business tax, like the proposal made by the Associated Oregon Industries, that a minimum tax should be simply a fee based on administrative costs or the like for administering the system, and that businesses should only be taxed on profitability. That's one argument, and in that, this certainly does not comply with that argument at all. The other argument, I think, and which is the one that I espouse, is that a business which is not profitability still takes up space in the economy, still uses government services and systems that are held in place as a result of government regulation and authority. They still use the court systems and a variety of other basic public services that we tend to think of as sort of background because we don't really think of the reality that those pieces of what establish the business environment within which businesses can operate at all are government. That's what they are. And if you believe that theory, then the idea that a business ought to be taxed in relationships to its size makes sense. Profitability, of course, still remains an issue for tax because that has to do with the ability to pay. But if you're going to accept the notion that businesses do use government services or benefit from government services even when they don't use them, then taxing on business size is reasonable, makes sense, and this corporate minimum proposal is based on that theoretical approach rather than the approach that business should only be taxed based on profitability. Those are the two theoretical approaches that we have received. I'm not aware of any others.
No, I think you said it well.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bailey has piqued my interest. So, I'd just like to What I'd like to look at is, given that there are two ways to, seemingly two competing ways to assess corporate taxation, one is based on profitability and one is this corporate minimum structure. For our discussion, for what we're doing here, profitability is a function of how we define it for tax purposes, and how we define income. From the discussions that you've had, do you feel like this discussion about the corporate minimum is something the business community would rather engage in rather than looking at our definition of income and trying to get at it on the profitability side? Does this seem to be the more pragmatic approach?
I believe it is. Our tax structure changed significantly a couple of sessions ago when we moved to a single sales factor for computing profitability in corporations. That benefited our high-tech industry. It benefited companies with a lot of sales outside of Oregon. And these companies, you know, it should be said, are just fabulous contributors of employment, of local property tax. But they did benefit from this single sales factor. And so when we look at something like a corporate minimum, you know, that's in some ways a way of retrieving a little bit back of what the changes in our tax structure have lost.
If I could follow up, I appreciate that answer. And I guess I share the concerns that I think a lot of folks in this room share, which is that there is a capacity within the corporate minimum context to have a more unfair tax structure. It's simpler. Much simpler to administer, simpler to understand from the business side of things. So I see that there's a good trade-off there, even from the business perspective, from dealing with it on this side. But I feel those concerns would be better assuaged knowing that the people who are going to be paying, the corporations that are going to be paying this tax, you know, on balance, given the choices of re-examining the single sales factor and the wisdom of that policy choice, or tweaking the corporate minimum structure. If on balance they prefer the corporate minimum structure, it would make me feel a little less concern about going down this road and using the corporate minimum as the vehicle. So I just, if that's where we're going to, then my concerns are very much assuaged, so I appreciate that. And you feel free to comment on that if you have any comments.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we've had good participation. I mean, I think you're going to get some pushback from our friends in the business community, but we have had a willingness to look at, to look at a good corporate minimum from parts of the business community, and I think that's an encouraging thing. But we'll let them speak for themselves.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 8.2%. Where does that leave us in relation to our neighboring states on C corporation tax rates?
Well, Washington State has no income tax no income tax at all. They tax their businesses differently with a business and occupation tax. Paul could probably be the person to do the detail on that.
Representative Benz, I believe our overall tax rate, in fact, our overall corporate tax income tax burden is right near the middle of the country right now. Corporate tax rates vary from about 3% to about 9% across the states. We have a detailed table from Federation of Tax Administrators we'll make available for the committee.
And I appreciate that. I guess the question is, again, Washington, could you know offhand how we will compare to Washington should this be adopted?
Well, Washington doesn't have a net income tax, so there isn't a comparison with the 8.2%. They do have a business and occupation tax, which is the business occupation tax in Washington varies from about 0.5%, I think, up to over 1%, depending on the industry. They tend to have a lower rate for export-based industries than they do for ones that are sell within the state. So that's the comparison would be with the B&O tax, which is considerably higher than the minimum rate here we're looking at. But on the net income, isn't incomparable.
Thank you.
Representative Brin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question more for Paul, although the chairs, if I'd love to hear your comments on this as well. Paul, without endorsing or not endorsing the concepts that have gone into this, can you give me your just back of the napkin, 10,000 foot analysis on the incentivizing or disincentivizing, if that's the right way to say it, effects from a marginal tax rate perspective, not an effective tax rate perspective, but a marginal tax rate perspective, specifically the two hard numbers? It's a pretty steep tax increase to go from $249,999 in net income to $250,000, as well as pretty solid increase to earn one more dollar over $500,000 in top line revenue. That marginal tax aspect, as well as any mitigating factor that would cause by not having some sort of inflation adjustment on those two sets of numbers, and I don't think that's part of the package, although correct me if I'm wrong. Representative. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, the two pieces I think really do have different effects, especially in terms of the revenue stream to the state, but also in terms of how they might influence decisions. Keep in mind that the rates in this in the proposal, both the gross receipts-based minimum and the net income rates, they're both marginal rates. So you're going to, regardless of how profitable you are, you've got your first $250,000 would be taxed at the 6.6. And the same is true with the gross receipts. It's going to be just the amount above $500,000 that the marginal rate applies to. The gross receipts-based tax is probably going to have a very minimal effect on behavior, because it's gross receipts is a very broad base. The rate is very low. It's going to be a relatively stabilizing component for the corporate revenue stream. It does have less. It's more likely to influence businesses that are just getting over that threshold, because there's really very little you can do to avoid it. I mean, it's based on gross receipts, and there's not much that can be done to avoid that. The rate structure on the net income is more likely to have a behavioral effect, because it's on a net income base. And it would be based on profitability. So that's where you're more likely to see a marginal effect. But again, it has to be in the context of Oregon's overall business tax structure, Oregon's overall economy. And within that context, you have to compare those other factors and see how that will weigh out. And one of the things to keep in mind was when you went through the business household splits, that the studies that were done by Ernst & Young, that Oregon is very competitive relative to other states in terms of its business tax, overall business tax burden. As a percent of gross state product, we were in the lowest five. So there is from that standpoint, the state is pretty competitive at this point. You may lose some of that if no other states change, but again, as Senator Burdick said, I think we can anticipate some responses from other states in their tax structure to the current fiscal crisis.
Seeing no other questions, we thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And the reins back.
Well, when I moved down to the witness table, there were no witnesses, and now there are two pages.
Thanks, Speaker, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, I think we'll just start at the top. Do you want to talk about it? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Chris?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, kind of following up on Representative Bence's question, on the back of your revenue impact statement, there is a distributional impact table. And this is focused on, this is for tax year 2009 and broken up in two pieces, the minimum tax piece and the marginal tax rate piece. And so a couple of things to point out there. First, I just wanted to draw attention to it because I think it gets at least part of Representative Bence's question. For the minimum tax, for those with organ sales less than $500,000, we can see the increase there would be $90, and that's going from the $10 to the $100. And I did want to point out the minimum tax here. As the committee recalls, the Department of Revenue in 2006 got an AG opinion that the current $10 minimum tax actually applied to all affiliates and not just kind of return-based. This plan would ensure that it's the return-based and that these structures would not apply to each affiliate independently. And so the minimum tax, the average impact, these are for those that are affected, and increases up to about $53,000 on average. So again, that's due to the $60,000 cap. And overall, about 77% of taxpayers are affected by the minimum tax, and this is borne by roughly two-thirds of corporations now pay the minimum tax. So those two-thirds are going to be affected, obviously. And then the difference between the two-thirds and 77% will be folks who pay above the minimum tax, pay more than the $10, but pay less than this formula would get them to. The marginal tax piece of the table over there on the right shows very little impact on the lower income, or on the corporations with smaller sales, and up to about 50% of the corporations being affected for, or at the top end for companies of $50 million of sales or more. Overall, 5% of the corporations would be affected by the top marginal tax rate, and again, that's due to the concentrated distribution in the corp system as it is. Most of the tax and most of the taxable income is concentrated at the high end of taxpayers with large dollar amounts. So, and then the average increase there at the top end for those with greater than $250 million in sales is an increase of $397,000. So I just wanted to point out the distributional tables. So you can chew on those for a little bit.
Okay. So you don't even get to a third of the businesses being affected by the marginal rate in a category until you get to the $10 million to $15 million Oregon sales category.
That's correct.
Yeah, and then you get to half at the $100 million to $250 million category.
On average, yes.
Right. And of course, those are very small categories, but it looks to me, based on what you've said, as though the vast majority of corporations in Oregon won't be affected by the marginal rate at all.
Right. Overall, about 5% of them. And that's on the total line.
I'll clear at the bottom. I got you. Okay.
The total line.
I'm busy drawing lines across. I wasn't looking that far down. Other questions? I think that gets to some of the questions you were asking as well. Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and take the first panel, and these aren't going to divide up very easily. So let's just take the first two, John Chandler and John Marshall.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I'm not sure if superlatives are ever necessary or appropriate in a committee. If they were, I would like to state our absolute horror at this proposal that's in front of you. I want to give you a few statistics to think about. I'm not going to get into the philosophical argument about tax reform in the middle of a recession or the impact of business on the public fisc and all that. That's more theological, as far as I can tell, than factual. Entertaining, but not at this time of day. there's an 18.7 unemployment rate for construction in Oregon right now. We represent about one in every 20 jobs. We're taking about one in five hits in unemployment. 19,000 jobs in construction, both residential and commercial, have been lost since this time last year. 35,000 jobs have been lost since the start of the decline. 3,100 jobs lost in April alone. These are good family wage jobs. That doesn't count the tertiary job loss. That doesn't count the realtors, the title companies, the lenders, the suppliers, all the other things that go along with the construction. That's the reality of my industry right now. Residential construction has come essentially to a halt in this state. It is as grim as I've ever seen it. We've had horror stories. I won't belabor you with them. Point of all that is when you look at this proposal in front of you, as it applies to construction, let me give you some facts I received from one of my members. There's a company in Chapter 11 right now. I talked to you about this one before. It's worth going through again. 2005, they had gross sales, gross receipts, $173,400,000. They employed 68 people. 2006, total gross receipts, $136,400,000. So they lost $40 million in sales, still kept the same 68 people. 2007, $103,800,000. So they dropped another $30 million in sales. Now they're down to 60 employees. 2008, the roof caved in. $37,600,000 in sales, 29 employees, so they shed over 40 employees, or over 30 employees. 2009 projected, $30,400,000 in sales, down to 26 employees. Under this proposal, that company, in Chapter 11, 26 employees, would pay $45,600 in corporate minimum tax. Folks, that's absurd. That's absolutely absurd. And I read that. I've got emails coming from other of my members. You'll hear from other construction industry people, I expect. At least I hope you do. That isn't something we can absorb. That's firing people. That's laying people off or closing a business down. And I'm not being hyperbolic. That's the reality of our business. Now, I understand we're not the only factor in the Oregon economy, but we're not an insignificant one. And for an income tax-driven state, leaving aside excise tax or corporate minimums and such as that, for an income tax-driven state, I would submit to you, I would ask you to think about, please, what this state needs is more income that can be taxed, not to go the other direction and put companies like my members, like other construction companies, like our tertiary suppliers and subs and everybody else, in the position of having to shed employment in order to pay a corporate minimum. I understand the box you're in. I really do. I don't make light of it. I understand the problems facing the state. I really do. This is not the right answer. This bill in front of you, this proposal in front of you, is not the right answer. I would ask you please to not pass it. We cannot support it or anything that looks remotely like it. I'll be glad to take questions.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing Associated Oregon Industries, good morning. I think John has pretty aptly described the impact of the current recession on one segment of the private sector economy. And you'll recall from your discussion last week of the revenue forecast that the construction sector is not alone in terms of the impact and the job losses. 250,000 Oregonians are out of work, 12% unemployment rate. And that obviously has is driven significantly by business activity and lack thereof. A page from your revenue forecast showed that 07-09, the biennium we're currently in, corporate income taxes are off 70% year over year. And that means that businesses are not making any money. And as a result, are forced to lay off people, which creates the unemployment rate. The proposal before you, which, by the way, I should have started off indicating that we oppose, proposes a 42% increase in corporate taxes just from the minimum and the corporate income tax rate when compared to the May forecast of corporate tax revenue in the next biennium. 42%. We've always been interested in comprehensive tax reform. I think we all recognize the volatility of our tax structure. I've been through it at least three times, this one included. Some of you have only been through it once. And every single time we've gone through one of these downturns, people say we've got to do something differently so it doesn't happen again. We've got to talk about saving for our rainy day. Well, we'll get to that maybe the next one, or between now and the next one, and by the time the next one gets here, it's often too late. And we would encourage you not to look in terms of the proposed amendments to House Bill 3405 as permanent reform being driven by this current budget crisis. I think we can learn a lot if we look at our forebears that were here in the early 1980s when they recognized that the downturn was temporary, we'd grow out of it, and they undertook temporary solutions. And we would encourage you to back away from these permanent draconian changes, we would suggest, and look at temporary solutions to get through this. The forecast you've seen shows that we will grow out of this, and I think we'd be better poised to grow quicker and more sustainably if we would not look at increasing taxes on our Oregon businesses by upwards of 42%. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Call.
Yeah, John, I just wanted to say that I appreciated your comments. You bring, I don't think I've had a chance to say this publicly, but I've got to work with you on a few other issues, and I think that you bring a very thoughtful and unique perspective to all of these discussions that we've had. And I think the perspective of the small construction, of the construction industry is... Well, it's very informative and very important to the debate, so thank you.
Thank you very much. And I've lost my list. There it is. Barry. Mike Morgan, Marion Haynes.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. As you know, I've been before this committee before to present a plan that OBA had developed around both the corporate minimum and a temporary increase on the corporate excise tax. We thought that was a very reasonable and responsible plan given the crisis that the state was in. We were also mindful in developing that plan that we needed to take care to ensure against unintended consequences in the way of further job losses, which would lead to further revenue deterioration for the state and simply prolong the position that we're in. So we did not approach our plan with the mindset of looking at major structural changes and tax fairness at this point. That's really a different conversation and probably a conversation that needs to happen another day when we're not in the middle of this kind of crisis. We were simply looking at what we could do reasonably and responsibly to help contribute toward finding a solution to the problem that we're in now. We have our board chair, Mike Morgan, down here with us today, and he'll talk in a little bit more detail about our thinking that went into that and our response to the plan that's before you today.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and committee members. Thanks for allowing us to appear. I'm Mike Morgan, managing partner of the Tonkin Torp Law Firm, located right next door to your shop, Representative Bailey, and the chair of the Oregon Business Association. We have a broad-based membership, very large companies, the largest employers in the state, small companies, rural companies, traded sector companies, service companies, about every kind you can imagine of all shapes and sizes. When we realized the depth of the budget problem that was brought to our attention fairly early on in 2009 that we were having, we thought that we needed to take some action on behalf of the business community to see what is it that the business community could do and could contribute to solving the temporary problem we hoped that we all had, and we hoped it was not more than temporary. We put together a couple of months ago an economic crisis task force represented by a number of our different companies, different sizes, including small businesses, They came up with the plan that you have seen, I think, down here. We have presented publicly and has been talked about at some length, including an increase in the corporate minimum tax, including an increase, and that was a permanent increase in the corporate minimum tax, a permanent increase in some fees, and temporary increases on an across-the-board 1% basis in the corporate excise tax and the personal income tax. The driving principles behind that was that we felt that we needed to make a contribution as a business community. We needed to do something other than sit back and simply criticize what other people were doing. But we needed to have a plan that would help us grow our way out of the economy, minimize job losses, and minimize the length of time it takes to get through the severest recession probably any of us have ever seen. To repeat what Marion said, and I would add, this proposal comes at a time when virtually all of our businesses have at a minimum frozen all salaries. Almost all of them have a substantial drop in their gross revenue. Most of them have laid off a substantial part of their workforce. Most of them have cut pay for everybody in the organization. And I would add from my personal experience, a great many of them have made substantially greater pay cuts in their executive compensation than anything else. Frankly, our businesses are simply trying to hold the critical mass of their people talent together to try to get through this. Nonetheless, they're willing to make some contribution. Basically, our view of this is we need to get through the crisis. It may be that we need long-term structural change. It may be that the tax system needs to be made, quote, fairer. But that's a different conversation that needs to take a lot more time than we've got in order to get the job done that's necessary to get us through 09 and through the next biennium. And therefore, we think permanently adopting any of these changes is absolutely the wrong thing to do right now. We are perfectly happy to sit down and join the task forces that are already going at looking at long-term structural change and join in that debate and, frankly, work towards legislation for the next legislative session. Now's not the time to do it, and that's what we didn't propose it. So we do support the temporary corporate excise tax increases. We do not support permanent adjustments. We do have grave concerns about the change in the gross receipts tax we propose to what you have before you. Corporate minimum, because it becomes a gross receipts tax, that's one of the things we'd like to avoid. One of the incubators of Oregon's economy has been the fact that if you're not making money, you don't pay a lot in taxes. And that's been one of the problems that Washington's economy has suffered to some degree. You can make no money and you still owe taxes. So in meeting with one of the representatives the other night, one of our small members said, well, let's see, I moved my minimum tax. This is a 27-person sustainable industries firm, grossing $3 million, making no money, as a great many startup companies are doing. I was willing to go to a $500 corporate minimum tax. The proposal that's in front of you would move that to $4,500. Well, you don't have to do much of that, and you're getting pretty close to one of the 27 jobs over a period of time. I think I will leave it at that. I have some difficulty with the idea that we need to, all of a sudden today, in the midst of the worst crisis we have, permanently change what we're doing in our excise taxes to the degree that is proposed, based on a notion of fairness. That is, how is it that this was unfair when we came into this? All of a sudden, we recognized it was unfair, and now we've got to change it. It's not good public policy. It's not the way to approach the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Ms. Haynes, I said before, and I'll say again, I think it's actually pretty remarkable that we have a business group in this state that took it upon themselves to generate an increase, a proposal for a significant increase in their tax burden and to bring that forward before the legislature, and I think we're all very appreciative of that. I want to hone in a little bit on understanding where some of the differences are in the package. It sounds to me, I guess my first question is it correct to say that it sounds like the two major concerns are one with the permanence of some portions of the proposal before you, and two with the structure of the corporate minimum change. Is that a correct summation?
Well, and you can chime in too. I think an overriding problem with respect to the personal income tax changes that we think are going to get proposed and the corporate changes, but I'll just address corporate right now, is that they are now proposed to be permanent rather than temporary. And we're having a hard time coming to grips with that, and I can pretty well assure you we won't be able to. This is not the time to make those kinds of changes and make them permanent. Seems to me about the worst time that you could do it. So that's number one. Secondly, our view was that an across-the-board small percentage increase that just hit everybody and got us through the crisis was the right way to go, based upon the system we have in place today, rather than changing the system or rather than substantially changing the marginal rates for one group of taxpayers. With respect to the corporate minimum tax, our view was that we would like to put forward a system that recognized the corporate minimum tax we've had is out of date. We need to raise some revenue. We would like to make it as neutral as possible to the conduct of doing business, and we would like to assure that it has a minimal impact on small businesses. That's what we've done. We think that what is proposed today in front of you hits small businesses too heavily, is too high a tax, and starts to look like a gross receipts tax, which really nobody wants. I realize those are some fine distinctions, but that's how we view it. Is there anything else?
I would just add that, we, on the corporate minimum side, we worked very carefully and really put a lot of thought into the tiers, the stair steps, as you mentioned before, and where a minimum flat amount within that step should be pegged. We worked with an accountant. We did reach out to a number of our businesses, both big and small, and talked to them about these impacts. On the small business side, as Mike said, we've heard from our members that the proposal before you today is worse for small businesses. It impacts them harder than what we've proposed. We've talked to large corporations under our proposal, too, that have said, We can support this because we understand that the services are important and we care about the state going forward. But make no mistake that this is a significant increase and we may cut jobs based on this proposal. And that's what we're really, really concerned about, is that we're taking actions. We're not having the kind of conversations that we need with business people to understand what the true impacts are, and that will actually force more job losses, more revenue losses for the state at exactly the wrong time. It's what we're not trying to do here. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Let me take the second part of this first with regards to the corporate minimum. I'm hearing two issues within the corporate minimum: one, the magnitude, and two, the structure. With regards to the structure, could you help us understand why a stair step based on the size of the business is preferable to a smooth function based on the size of the business?
I think that, one, it's easy for people to understand. And if you look at where it hits, it actually, when we spoke with an accountant, it's we really tried to peg things at a place where people could absorb the cost of the minimum that we proposed. And you are able to, hold it down a little bit some within that category rather than things just escalating at such a fast rate. If you look at the differences in the proposal and where it escalates, ours really is... The proposal before you today really ramps up much more quickly on the low level, even if it starts after 500,000. Ours is much more flat and then really peaks quite a bit at the high end. Those larger corporations that one could argue have a larger impact on the revenue of the state. So I think that's. I mean, it's because of how exactly we structured it and where the numbers come out that it really kind of works.
Well, I think there's a practical aspect to it as opposed to a theoretical beauty. We had large and small corporations, service businesses, traded sector businesses, and any number of them, talking about the issue, what would be a reasonable permanent minimum corporate tax that you won't say you're indifferent to, but that do not have drastic impacts at any of these levels. That's how those numbers were come up with. Also, just to raise a reasonable amount of revenue, frankly. So if you look at our proposal, you go from 500 to 1,000 once you cross the $10 million line. You're probably at a point of indifference on that extra $500 around $10 million. I mean, this is really very practical.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So is it correct to say then that the issue is the speed of acceleration and increase in the tax and the shape of that curve as opposed to the method by which that tax is calculated? The reason I ask is that we heard some discussion of the gross receipts aspect of it, and where my confusion has been is the stair-step methodology is also based on a measure of the size of the business, and so I'm trying to understand why that method is preferable to this one, and it sounds like it's not in measuring the size of the business, it's in the shape of the curve for the tax for that business. Is that a correct summation?
Well, I was not there for all of the debate, so I can't tell you the exact answer. But you could presumably work either of these theories in to a point of indifference between the two of them because they are, in fact, both based on gross receipts. So I think the differences are in the shape of the curve and the magnitude. That's it. We think your curve's wrong and it's too high. It's pretty simple.
I guess the other thing I would add is that I agree with Mike that there is a practical aspect. The kind of concerns that you've heard from the other two that came before us are very real on those high-volume, low-margin businesses, and we've got a lot of those right now that are simply not profitable. So where exactly these numbers hit are very important in what a company can absorb given the level of their total sales. And we were really tried to be very, very thoughtful in how we did that and talked to many, many companies and said, you know, is this the right number that even though you're having an incredibly, incredibly difficult time right now, this is something that you can absorb, even though you may not like it, but the answer generally was yes. Under our plan, they would be able to do that.
Did you indulge another follow-up?
Sure.
Thank you. Moving to the original part of the line of questioning on corporate minimum, and then it seemed like the other issue was around permanence versus temporary and the change in the excise tax. On the issue of permanence, I understand the argument that we want to be careful if we're looking at long-term changes for short-term problems. I'm curious, given that the testimony we heard was around the economic problems that your members are facing right now in this crisis, what difference in the short run a temporary change versus a permanent change has? Is it a signaling effect? Is it does it affect a long-term investment? What sort of distortion does the long-term change to the tax structure have over a short-term change?
In the short term, if the rate changes and all other aspects were identical, then it would have no impact as a practical matter this year. What we're trying to do when we came forward was to see if we could exercise our part of being a good citizen in establishing good government and good public policy. We didn't think that trying to redo the tax system in the midst of the worst economic crisis than any of us can imagine represents good public policy making. When we've had task forces running for years on what our tax structure ought to look like, and we're prepared at any time to spend any number of hours to continue that dialogue and ultimately reach a conclusion that maybe our tax structures ought to be changed. We can't think of a worse time to do it right now. And frankly, I think people will feel like they've had the gun to their head. You know, if you don't do X, we'll make it worse for you. But it'll be just fine if we make it permanent. It's just the wrong time to do it. I don't believe that we could have gotten our members to put forward the proposal that's on the table today if we'd have had to make it permanent. So for whatever value that had to you, it would not have gotten in front of this legislative body if we'd have had to make those changes permanent. All of us are trying to just get through the next couple of years. The government needs to try to just get through the next couple of years. Then we need to figure out in the interim how we remake both business and government to try to avoid this kind of problem again.
Representative Reed, and then Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say I appreciate the exchange you had with Representative Bailey. I think that was very helpful to me, and echo his comments about our appreciation for your willingness to step forward with proactive and productive conversation. I'm interested. It seems some time has passed since your original proposal. It was a week ago, though it seems much longer, that we received the revenue forecast, which continued to make our job more difficult. And I wonder if your group has had a chance to talk about that and absorb that, and whether that has changed your thinking, whether it's about the methodology in your proposal or about the dollars that we're faced with trying to raise or cut or some combination. And to the extent you can be specific, I'd appreciate that too.
Internally, we've had no time to have that discussion other than to recognize that I think most of the proposal we have would take care of most of the problem. Marion, I don't know if you and Ryan have come down and worked with any of the groups and gone through this in any detail. I know as an organization, we have not had the time to do it. We had a board meeting the other night at which we took up, discuss some of the issues that are on the table in gross as opposed to getting down to the details.
The only thing I would add is, and this goes back to what I said originally, is that the premise that we worked from on this is that we need to step up and be part of the solution. And we never tried to solve the problem. We knew that we couldn't. We knew that the impacts on businesses as far as job losses and unintended consequences would get too big. We didn't say, here's the number we need to get to for the corporate contribution. We tried to build it rather from the ground up and say, what can we reasonably do that will not drive businesses to have to make even more awful decisions about laying off employees and things of that nature. So we didn't come to it from, here's the number we're trying to hit, how do we build up to get there? We said, what can we do? And we stretched ourselves to get to what we did and stopped before we thought that we would kind of tip the scale and frankly make things worse.
Thank you.
We started with the premise, excuse me, in a meeting that preceded, frankly, us putting together an economic crisis task force with Representative Nolan. And I think the one thing that every business in the room, and there were about 35 of them at the time, felt unanimously was everybody has to make a contribution to solving the crisis. Nobody gets off free. When we're sitting out here laying people off, freezing salaries and so forth, there's no free lunch for anybody. So, and to reiterate what Marion said, we said, what is a good contribution from business? What's a reasonable contribution from business to recognize that business needs to take a part of the pain that needs to be felt by everybody in order to get through this? That's about as detailed as it gets.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may, I had two questions.
Please.
The first was going to this issue of jobs, and I wondered if you could help me with this teeter-totter that's going on in my mind. So I hear what you're saying, and I'm very concerned about doing anything that would drive jobs out of the state or force further layoffs. And then I go back and I look at this shortfall that we have to fill and recognize that within that shortfall are jobs, police officers, teachers, alcohol and drug counselors. How would you suggest that we balance that push and pull of of the jobs, because on the net issue of jobs, as you said, we're trying to get through this. There is no free lunch. There's going to be a lot of pain across the board. Whichever way we go, there's a job that's going to be lost. What would your advice be about how to make that choice?
I'm not sure that we have a general advice for you. I recognize that problem because it is a job problem all the way across the board, and if you have to cut, you know, government services, something has to be done. But it would be helpful to see some flexibility as to what's done, and I don't know the degree to which the state's hands are tied. But I do know, for instance, that in my own organization, our employees have said, we'd rather you do pay cuts across the board than fire people. We'd rather you furlough us than fire people. So there is some flexibility even within the systems that we all have as to how you deal with the problem and how you spread the pain within your own organization. That said, tremendous numbers of private sector jobs have been lost already. I don't know. I've not added it up for the public sector. We focused on how do we minimize that, because typically the private sector is the engine that drives the growth, that drives the increases in revenue, that drives the increases in employment, generally speaking, that drives the money that can come into the state coffers that can pay for the public services that we need. So if our private sector sinks at a more rapid rate than our public sector, we think, yes, it probably is going to be harder to come back. Do I know that for sure? I don't know that for sure, but that's a premise that we have. And when private sector jobs start coming back, they can come back fairly quickly. They probably can come back faster than government jobs can come back, and you can get payrolls going fairly quickly, and you can get revenue coming into the state fairly quickly. So you've got a chance of rebounding out of it. That's my view. I think that's a fairly consistent view of our members, but it's hardly a complete analysis of a humongous economic problem.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that answer. I think that the challenge here is that clearly, like everybody else, government is going to have to tighten its belt. And I think what you see in the proposal that came out Monday from the co-chairs is a balance there, with $2 billion in reductions and $800 million in proposed new revenue. Clearly, the balance is going on the side of cuts. I agree with you that there are some ways to manage within the organization. In this case, the organization is government. And I personally think that furloughs and wage freezes are part of it. But this problem is so big that we can't furlough and wage freeze our way out of this. There has to be that additional revenue. And for that reason, I'm really grateful that you have stepped up and are willing to engage with us as we try to solve this problem. But the other question I have goes to the issue of timing. And I've heard a refrain this morning from both panels about how this just, it's not the time. It's not the time to make permanent changes. It's not time to make significant structural changes. And I'm thinking back to sitting on this committee 2 years ago when we had the opposite type of economy, and the economy was booming and we were moving forward and we were talking about making structural changes. And what I heard then was, this isn't the time. So I'm wondering if the boom time isn't the time and the starvation time isn't the time, when is the time?
Well, you've asked a great philosophical question to which I actually have no answer, because as a society, we all tend to push off trying to solve problems until they're just about to drag us down to the bottom. And that's an unfortunate fact of sort of how we run businesses, run government, and to some degree, I suspect, even live our lives. And so it does take a good crisis to get things going. I don't know how to answer that with respect to the good times, but we need to answer it. I've been down here to testify on establishing more substantial state reserves and changing the kickers and getting the rainy day fund to be something that is actually rational and used rationally. That needs to be done in good times. So you got to just keep at it, I think. I'm not sure there's a great answer to that. But I do know that what you're doing right now and what our members are doing is we're trying to make it up on the run. And we're running as hard as we have ever had to run, and we're not even sure what direction we're running. And we're looking at more uncertainty in the short term, I mean literally month to month, than any of us have ever dealt with before. So if I go to my members and I say, as we have, permanent change in fee structure, permanent change in a corporate minimum we put together, they all feel comfortable that over a period of time, those permanent changes are not going to be damaging and they can manage them. They're scaled to be able to do that. But you come in and you talk about a huge 30% increase in the corporate income taxes for some of our companies and say, how's that on a permanent basis? A really, really large income, a really large effectively gross receipts tax, you want to do that permanently? We don't even have time to think about how that works for our companies because we're not spending our time doing that. We're spending our time figuring out how we're going to keep our payroll together tomorrow. That's what I mean when I say now's not the time.
Mr. Chair, can I have one more question?
Yes,
and then
please.
Then a brief comment. On that issue of permanency and going to your members, we are in a time of great uncertainty. Businesses are struggling with that. We're certainly struggling with that. We have a very short period of time and millions of people that are counting on all of us to make smart decisions that are going to keep people at work and protect the services that we all care about. On the issue of permanency, is there any value that's purchased with permanency in stability? So recognizing how we're all chasing a solution here because of the breathtaking nature of the shortfall that we face, and knowing that coming back 2 years from now, we'll find ourselves without the resource of over $1 billion in federal stimulus money and without the resource of the reserve funds that this legislature did build in the 2007 session with your help in creating the rainy day fund. Is a temporary nature more valuable than being able to plan in the long run and being able to build stability in the communities to continue to attract a high-quality workforce here so that they're not faced with these types of reductions every 2 years?
I don't know the answer to that question. What I do know is I can't convince my membership that what you want to make permanent that we haven't agreed to should be permanent. Irrespective of what the right answer to this is, the practical reality is we were able to get unanimous vote from our board to put on the table the proposal we made. And if I go to them today and ask them for what they would do on the nature of permanence, I would have a unanimous vote no. It's just practical. They just can't get there right now, and I don't think they're going to.
The other thing that I would add is I don't think permanency brings certainty or stability. In this kind of economic climate, we're seeing huge swings in corporate income. That's going to stay the same even if the rate goes up and stays there on a permanent basis. There will still be large fluctuations in corporate income. That's the nature of the beast, and we know that. That's why there's different levels in the proposal about the kicker reform. Different standard deviations applied to the corporate side than the individual side because there are swings in that. So permanently changing the corporate excise rate doesn't get stability. Doing the reforms that we need in the kicker, building the kind of rainy day fund that we need, that's where we get the stability in the system that we're going to need going forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I just a brief comment?
Sure.
I really appreciate it. Back on the question of timing, I think you're right. It is human nature, especially on the toughest problems, to put them off into the future. In the legislature, the way we do that, we really like to study things. We like to have task forces. We like to have interim work groups. We don't have time this time for a task force or an interim work group. We have roughly 6 weeks to come up with a solution that will help hopefully create the stability to take us through the next 2 years. I'm really glad that you're here today. I commend the revenue chairs from both the House and the Senate for bringing us a proposal here today, and I hope that we can be engaged every day in coming up with a solution that is going to fill this hole. I think we have to. Whether or not we want this to be the time, this is the time to take a bold action to be able to get through the next 2 years. The circumstances aren't going to allow for a long additional study or procrastination.
I think we agree with you on that, and getting through the next 2 years and what we could reasonably do to help the state through that is was exactly our thinking and putting on the table what we did.
I was going to ask you what you agreed with about this plan. I think you just answered that question. Representative Call.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you guys for answering all of our questions. Last week when we had the revenue forecast, some really smart economists, when I asked a question about what we should do in the short term, how we could manipulate the tax code, what things we could do to try to spur development, spur economic growth, I think to a person, in different answers to that question, they all came back and said we need to maintain our investment in our education system and that we need to take the long view. And that to their perspective, taking the long view on our economy and not just simply looking at the short-term crisis was probably the best thing we could do in these economic times. And I think that the co-chair's budget represents that value that we place on education, not just in providing for the next generation, but really the economic value that's there. I sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Public Safety, and while we would like to be able to really wring some money out of that system, our sentencing in the state and the choices that the voters have made it very difficult for us to do that. And so when I look at this current situation as a kind of from a business frame of mind, and I look at the fact that cutting education really doesn't help us but actually hinders us in the long term with regards to economic development and recovery, and the fact that the Department of Corrections and the public safety budget is somewhat sacrosanct, is very hard to get at. The only area where we're going to be able to move to cut things is to really take a hard look at the DHS budget. And given that we're pulling down $2 to every one that we put in there, I'm having a hard time finding that there's real good business sense in cutting that budget. Because for every dollar we cut there, we're losing three. And for every dollar we can try to find to put in there, we're pulling down two more. And
of course, you're referring to the federal match.
Right, the federal match.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, from a business perspective, you know, given that we've got three big parts of our budget, two of which we're really not going to touch, and the third of which is where we could potentially make some cuts, even though they would be very harmful, what a business person would do faced with this problem, how they would view this problem and the proposals that are before us?
To the long-term view, I would say that we totally agree with you. We didn't just come up with a revenue proposal. We actually looked at the budget and looked at where we would make cuts. Education, we feel, is hugely important. Actually, in the budget that we put forward, I think we actually did a little better for education than what the co-chairs came out with. So that was definitely part of our thinking, preserving for the long term. But I think it's important that we balance the long term and the short term. We could take some actions now in the short term that could actually harm the long term. There's no easy answer. I mean, there's not, I can't tell you, here's where you should make the cuts, here's where you should raise the revenue, and that everything's going to work out beautifully in the end. I mean, this is painful for everybody. The proposal that we put on the table is going to cause pain for businesses. As much as we're advocating for that, it will still cause pain. There will be pain, and we're not going to be able to get around that. But I think that balancing the long term and the short term is important. That was very much top of mind when we were working on our plan.
I don't know that there's a very good answer to that question, but I think if you ask the business people what they are doing in their own organizations, they are going to tell you that nothing is off limits. Every piece of the business gets to pay part of the price, and you hope that the price isn't so big that the business doesn't survive it. Very few businesses have sacred cows at a time like this. How does that translate to state government? I'll leave it to you. But part of this goes back to the question of how do you spread the pain? And every organization has to figure out differently how it's going to do that. What's going on in the private sector is layoffs and pay cuts, and the people who have jobs are very happy to have jobs, even if that job does not pay as much as it paid last year. And that's just the reality, and those are actually being done across the board. And as I said, in my client base, the senior executives are taking much larger cuts. So if the staff of the organization is taking 10, in many cases they're taking 30 and 50% cuts to start with.
Well, I want to say this has been an astounding interchange between you and the committee, and I appreciate it very much. Mr. Morgan, your acknowledgement of the fact that we're in a tough spot, I appreciate very much, and also that your organization's willingness to come forward with a very forward-looking proposal. I also appreciate that. Very much. And a couple of observations which may not be entirely on point, but I think perhaps they are. I think there's some misperception perhaps in the business community based on your remarks about how well prepared we are in connection with these proposals. The legislature has actually been working on these proposals in the general sense for a long time. The first proposal that actually reached the floor of the House that I recall in this topic area was the business activity tax proposal brought to the floor by Chair Lane Shetterly, and I believe it was in 2005. It may have been earlier than in 01. In 2001, my very first year, Paul Werner tells me, the very first year I was here. So the legislature has actually been working on this concept and these proposals for a long time. This is not simply a response to an immediate crisis. It's a response to a long-term an understanding that there's a long-term structural issue. I think perhaps that your observation that people start to act when there's a crisis may have more validity, because I think these kinds of proposals have more salience at a time like this. But it's not as though we came across this idea a couple of months ago and have just suddenly worked it up. We've been actually working on these general ideas for a long time, and they're bipartisan. I mean, Lane Shetterly, as you know, is a Republican, and was working on these same issues for a long time ago. Another comment I'd make is that I know that a part of your job in your firm, part of your firm's job, is to deal with the human nature that people tend to put off until the time they have to get something done, and your firm's job as lawyers is to see that that doesn't happen, and that in fact they make plans ahead of time. And I see by your grin you agree with that.
I would say we are. That would be part of our job.
Yes,
the
of course.
Degree of success varies with each passing day and the clients that we're dealing with.
Well, and then of course the other part of your job comes into play. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much, and your candor and awareness of all of these issues.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I want to take just a few more minutes on this bill today. There are a number of people we're not going to get to. I have one person that I especially want to hear from on another bill. I want to take the last 10 minutes for that. So let's see if we can hear from Dana Hepper, Catherine Pedersen, and John Mullen in just a few minutes. And I'll apologize to the others who we're not going to be able to hear from until Tuesday. In order to meet our time schedule, the House is convening at 10:15, I think. Yes. Please.
Hi, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director for Stand for Children. Thanks, Chair Barnhart and the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. I'll make three quick points and turn it over to Catherine. First, I wanted to note that Representative Brune made a a depth point about incentives and disincentives. And I also just wanted to add to that conversation that there are a number of reasons why we as individuals and many of us as business owners decide where to do business. And one of those factors is the tax system in that state. But there are many other factors that influence those decisions as well, including the effectiveness of the public school system, the effectiveness of the public safety system, and the infrastructure the state provides to support effective business. My mom has a sole proprietorship that she runs out of Portland, and the reason she runs it there is because that's where our family lives. The second thing I wanted to note was on the policies themselves. On the corporate income tax proposal specifically, I spent a lot of time in the interim studying corporate income tax and corporate tax systems of other states and trying to figure out, just from my own knowledge, what Oregon could do. And so I just wanted to highlight a couple things that I learned there. One is that, of course, the corporate income tax is impacting businesses that are still profitable in Oregon in these tough times. And so asking those that are actually still the most successful during these times to contribute to the infrastructure makes incredible sense to me. 80% of the profits reported in Oregon are actually from out-of-state corporations, so I think we run a very low risk there of having an adverse impact on Oregon jobs and Oregon businesses. And also just want to make the point that all of us pay a 9% income tax rate on the vast majority of our taxable income. And I think Oregonians could really support fairness there between what they all pay on their taxable income and what our largest, most profitable corporations pay on their taxable income. And finally, in terms of timing, I think the point's been made, so I'll be brief, but we've had the corporate minimum tax at $10 for over 80 years, and so that means at least 40 legislative sessions to do something about it. And so I think Representative Gelser already made the point that we've had many studies, task forces, interim work groups, et cetera, mull over this. We have a wealth of information in this area, and I think it's exactly the time to utilize the information we have and make a decision to move forward, whether that decision is what's laid out today or whether it's slightly different and changes in the next few weeks. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Catherine Pedersen. My husband has an oral and maxillofacial surgeon surgery practice here in Salem for the past 37 years, and I've been his bookkeeper for most of that time. As a business, we depend significantly on the public services provided by the state of Oregon, paid for by tax dollars, especially K through 12 and community college education. One example of this is the fact that we rely on skilled workers in our professional office, workers in areas of surgical assisting, technology, and office management. Finding these skilled employees has been our number one challenge as business owners. A second example is our hope, my husband's and mine, to transition our practice to a younger doctor who in all likelihood will come from another state. One of the first questions these highly educated specialists ask about is the tenuous situation in our public schools. Even though we depend on quality public services in our community, our business really doesn't directly contribute much towards supporting them. I understand you're considering two ways to change this, which I'm very pleased to hear about. First, we pay the $10 corporate minimum tax. Even though we're a small professional office with an average of 6 employees, it would not make a difference for us if we have to pay $10, $500, or $1,000 a year. Clearly, this committee has an important task in determining the policy that will adequately support critical public services and then ask businesses to contribute a reasonable, doable share of that cost. I urge you to finally settle this tough question this session. Second, I understand that profitable C corporations in Oregon pay a 6.6% tax on their profits. At the same time, S corporations, LLCs, and individuals mostly pay 9% on their income. You're considering House Bill 3405. We ask that you ensure that C corporations that are profitable in Oregon pay the same tax rate as other businesses. We're organized as a C corporation. Because all of our expenses are in Oregon, we do not technically have any profit on our tax return. Most C corporations that do have profit here are out-of-state corporations such as Office Depot and, I'm sorry, Home Depot and Walmart. It seems fair to me that when C corporations show a profit in Oregon, whether it's our oral surgery clinic or an out-of-state corporation, we pay the same tax rate on those profits as other businesses do. It seems to me that both of these solutions would make our tax system fairer and go a long way towards funding the quality education and other public services we depend on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I think that it's fair to say that there's not total agreement on this bill with the discussion that's been going on this morning, but I thank you for bringing it forward. What I do say is that there are probably two broad consensus points that practically everybody in the room would agree to. The first point being that times are tough, and the second point being that there's a need for shared responsibility. On the former point, I would just say that we have all been through the revenue forecast and the co-chair's budget. We know that the co-chair's budget counts on $800 million of revenue to get to the expenditure side, which in the Department of Human Services leaves many vital programs cut or in danger of really not being effective in the work that they do. So we're very, very concerned about that. The Human Services Coalition has not had a chance to take a position on this particular bill, but when it comes to that second point about shared responsibility, our approach is more lean towards the discussion about mirroring the same brackets for corporations as individuals, so 5, 7, and 9%. And that, again, would work for profitable corporations. And I know that's different than what is being proposed in this particular bill, but I think it makes sense to keep this discussion going and coming to some decisions. Of course, we have to make them very quickly in the days and weeks ahead. But I would just say that we're pleased to be part of this discussion, and we hope to see something that will be along the lines of the fairness principle that we have had long had as the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. We continue to be concerned about the amount that individuals and corporations pay in the state. And we know that another part of the solution is going to come back to personal income tax. So the degree that we can get a sense of fairness around this shared responsibility, and again, recognizing the fact that times are very difficult, we appreciate the efforts of this particular committee. Along with a very brief personal note, I've testified before this committee before that I'm president of a small C Corp outside of this, the work that I do on a day-to-day basis. I see this as part of a shared responsibility in a very personal sense. And one other note that I should make about the Human Services Coalition, we see that in your bill you talk about the raising fees for nonprofits. We have not tested that discussion, but I'm confident that if I talk to my colleagues, they would be part of that shared responsibility and say we can be part of a solution in Oregon as well.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony this morning very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3405. And plans to reopen it next Tuesday and open the work session on House Bill 2914 and ask Carrie Schoenfeld to come forward. Chris, would you just give us a very brief update on this bill, and then we'll hear from Carrie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2914 is a federal reconnect bill, and the way the bill is drafted is it would change the tie date for the definition of taxable income from December 31st, 2008 to December 31st, 2009. The only thing I would point out is that you actually cannot tie to a future date, so the bill couldn't become law the way it is because we haven't passed December 31st, 2009. It would have to be a date prior to the day that you would work on the bill.
So we'll pick another day. All right. Please.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, excuse me. For the record, my name is Carrie Schoenfeld. I am a CPA in Oregon, and I am the immediate past chair of the Oregon Society of CPAs and also a longtime member of the tax team. And I really appreciate your the opportunity to get to just say a few words today. I know you've had a lot of testimony. I think we would just really urge you to pass what we would call a rolling reconnect and to reconnect Oregon definition of income tax back to the federal definition. As you know, you disconnected in February, and so right now we are not tied to the federal definition. It's a concern of how we prepare tax returns, how the taxpayers report their taxes in the next year. What we expect to see is that Congress is going to start passing legislation probably this year that will actually increase taxes, and if those stay connected, then if to the extent that Oregon is connected to those increases in federal taxes, it will actually be a benefit to Oregon and will increase taxes. And you may ask why in the world we would favor that, but as CPAs for the past 25 to 30 years, we have really urged you to reconnect and to stay connected at all times to the federal tax code. Sometimes that means a revenue increase to all taxpayers, sometimes that's a decrease. But as you know, taxes are complicated enough, and if we don't stay connected, then it becomes even harder for all of the taxpayers and all of your constituents to file their tax returns. We find that it's hard to have out-of-state compliance. So I think that we see that this will be a revenue raiser as we move forward, and so that we really would urge you to adopt amendments to House Bill 2914 that would actually reestablish a rolling reconnect. We understand that there are some provisions in the legislation that passed Congress in February that could have a revenue deficit in Oregon. If you feel that you must disconnect from a few provisions, we would urge you to reconnect generally and disconnect from those that you just feel that you cannot tie to. I think otherwise it leaves taxpayers very uncertain how to file tax returns, particularly since we just have a legislature meeting every 2 years. We won't know what to file next year. And whether there will be a reconnect. So, again, we just urge that reconnect, and I appreciate your opportunity to speak before you.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Carrie, do you anticipate or do you know anything about what the federal folks are discussing as far as 2009 is concerned?
There aren't any real specifics that we're hearing other than it's going to have to be revenue raisers. There's so many things, but we're not really hearing specifics on what they're going to do. So at this point, other than, you know, income tax rates, which wouldn't probably flow through directly, but we're anticipating that there has to be increases at that level.
Well, is it anticipated, though, that the tax would be for tax year 2009, or is it anticipated that they would delay, or the federal government would delay anything until 2010?
That we don't know. Usually it will be correct into future years. However, in the past, we've had capital gain changes that were mid-year. We had one that came into effect for anything after a May date. So we really don't know. We know that they're desperate to raise taxes. Whether it might impact 2009, I would expect mostly it's going to be 2010. But the problem that we have right now is that we are disconnected for the 2009 tax year. So when we get into filing tax returns for 2009, Oregon taxpayers aren't going to be tied even to that 2009.
Yes, please.
I know this is asking you to speculate, but have you heard anything about what the Revenue Committee in Washington is focusing upon when it comes to the nature of the taxes that they're thinking of increasing, or is it just everything?
I suppose there's several different things we've heard. Capital gains taxes will probably go up to 20%, if not go away altogether. Again, that won't impact Oregon directly. The personal income tax, we've all heard of the increases there. There's issues for estate taxes. Again, that would not impact the rolling reconnect on family limited partnerships and some things that might be done there. So there's just a real broad spectrum. And right now, from what we're hearing from the Senate Finance Committee, everything's out there and there's so much going on, they don't know what might actually fall through. There's just so many things being discussed. So even, I think, at that level, they're uncertain as to what might come through.
And you didn't even mention the realization of income earned outside the United States.
Yes.
I'm not sure what that's called, but that's I know that's in the discussion.
Big issue.
Other questions? Let me just say that I am continually gratified by the reality that the legal profession and the accounting profession routinely come in here urging us to do things that would reduce their fees. The legal profession wants us to adopt uniform laws and a whole variety of other things that make the legal world simpler for ordinary folks, and you want us to do things that make preparing tax returns less expensive for ordinary folks. Mm-hmm. And I, for one, have to say I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, some fees don't make up for headaches, I think.
There you go. That's true.
Representative, that may very well be the case. Thank you. And as thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you've heard, this bill isn't anywhere near ready to work, but she was ready. It was available today, and I wanted to get her in. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2914. Paul, have I given the notices I need to give? I have. Okay. Committee's adjourned.